Spring Hill. All were hearsay and clearly inadmissible. All I would have needed to do was object, but I didn't. Though aware that they would appeal to the sympathies of the jury, I felt that justice should prevail over technicalities. The issue now was whether this girl should be sentenced to death, and this was an issue for the jury to decide, not me. I felt that in reaching that extremely serious decision, they should have any information even remotely relevant. Fitzgerald was both relieved and very grateful when I let them come in. Keith handled the direct examination of Jane Van Houten, Leslie's mother. Keith later told me that although Leslie's father didn't want to testify, he was behind Leslie 100%. Although, like the Krenwinkles, the Van Houtens were divorced, they too had stuck by their daughter. According to Mrs. Van Houten, Leslie was what you would call a feisty little child, fun to be with. She had a wonderful sense of humor. Born in the Los Angeles suburb of Altadena, she had an older brother and a younger brother and sister, the latter Korean orphans whom the Van Houtens had adopted. When Leslie was 14, her parents separated and divorced. "I think it hurt her very much," Mrs. Van Houten testified. That same year, Leslie fell in love with an older youth, Bobby Mackey, became pregnant, had an abortion, and took LSD for the first time. After that, she dropped acid at least once, and often two or three times a week. Patricia Krenwinkle had also taken LSD before meeting Manson. Very obese in her early teens, she began using diet pills at 14 or 15, then tried Reds, mescaline, and LSD, provided by her half-sister Charlene, now deceased, who was a heroin addict. During her freshman and sophomore years at Monrovia High School, Leslie was one of the homecoming princesses. She tried out again her junior year, but this time she didn't make it. Bitter over the rejection, she ran away with Mackey to Haight-Ashbury. The scene there frightened her, however, and she returned home to finish high school and to complete a year of secretarial training. Mackey, in the meantime, had become a novitiate priest in the Self-Realization Fellowship. In an attempt to continue their relationship, Leslie became a novitiate nun, giving up both drugs and sex. She lasted about 8 months before breaking with both Mackey and the yoga group. Mrs. Van Houten did not testify to the period which followed. Possibly she knew little, if anything, about it. From interviews, I'd learned that Leslie went full spectrum. The former nun was now anxious to try anything, be it drugs or answering sex partner ads in the Los Angeles Free Press. A longtime friend stopped dating her because she had become too kinky. For a few months, Leslie lived in a commune in Northern California. During this period, she met Bobby Beausoleil, who had his own wandering family, consisting of Gypsy and a girl named Gail. Leslie became a part of the ménage à quatre. Gail, however, was jealous, and the arguments became near constant. First, Gypsy split, moving to Spawn Ranch. Then, shortly after, Leslie followed, also joining Manson. She was 19. About this time, Leslie called her mother and told her that she had decided to drop out and that she wouldn't be hearing from her again. She didn't, until Leslie's arrest. Keith asked Mrs. Van Houten, "How do you feel about your daughter now?" Answer, "I love Leslie very much." Question, "As much as you always have?" Answer, "More." As the parents testified, one realized that they too were victims, just as were the relatives of the deceased. Calling the defendant's parents first was a bad tactical error on the part of the defense. Their testimony and plight evoked sympathy from everyone in the courtroom. They should have been called at the very end of the defense's case, just before the jury went out to deliberate. As it was, by the time the other witnesses had testified, they were almost forgotten. Shin called no witnesses on behalf of Susan Atkins. Her father, Shin told me, had refused to have anything more to do with her. All he wanted, he said, was to get his hands on Manson. A reporter from the Los Angeles Times had located Charles Manson's mother in a city in the Pacific Northwest. Remarried and living under another name, she claimed Charles' tales of childhood deprivation were fictions, adding, "He was a spoiled, pampered child." Kenneric did not use her as a witness. Instead, he called Samuel Barrett, Manson's parole officer. Barrett was a most unimpressive witness. He thought he first met Manson about 1956, around that. He couldn't remember whether Manson was on probation or parole. He stated that since he was responsible for 150 persons, he couldn't be expected to recall everything about each one. Repeatedly, Barrett minimized the seriousness of the various charges against Manson prior to the murders. The reason he did this was obvious. Otherwise, one might wonder why he hadn't revoked Manson's parole. One still did wonder. Manson associated with ex-cons, known narcotics users, and minor girls. He failed to report his whereabouts, made few attempts to obtain employment, repeatedly lied regarding his activities. During the first 6 months of 1969 alone, he had been charged, among other things, with grand theft auto, narcotics possession, rape, contributing to the delinquency of a minor. There was more than ample reason for parole revocation. During a recess, one of the reporters approached me in the hall. "God, Vince," he exclaimed. "Did it ever occur to you that if Barrett had revoked Manson's parole in, say, April of 1969, Sharon and the others would probably still be alive today?" I declined comment, citing the gag order as an excuse. But it had occurred to me. I had thought about it a great deal. On direct, Barrett had testified that there was nothing in Manson's prison records to indicate that he was a behavioral risk. Over Kenrick's objections, on cross-examination, I had him examine the folder on Manson's attempted escape from federal custody in 1957. The parade of perjurers began with Little Squeaky. Lynette Alice Frome, 22, testified that she was from an upper-middle-class background, her father an aeronautical engineer. When she was 17, she said, her father kicked her out of the house. "And I was in Venice, sitting down on a curb, crying, when a man walked up and said, 'Your father kicked you out of the house, did he?' And that was Charlie." Squeaky placed great importance on the fact that she had met Manson before any of the other girls, excepting only Mary Brunner. In questioning her about the family, Fitzgerald asked, "Did you have a leader?" Answer, "No, we were riding on the wind." "No leader, but..." "Charlie is our father, in that he would point out things to us." "Charlie was just like everyone else, but..." "I would crawl off in a corner and be reading a book, and he would pass me and tell me what it said in the book. And also he knew our thoughts. He was always happy, always. He would go into the bathroom sometimes to comb his hair, and there would be a whole crowd of people in there watching him, because he had so much fun." Squeaky had trouble denying the teachings of her lord and master. When Fitzgerald tried to minimize the importance of the Beatles' White Album, she replied, "There is a lot in that album. There is a lot." Although she claimed, "I never heard Charlie utter the words Helter Skelter," she went on to say that it is a matter of evolution and balance, and the black people are coming to the top as it should be. Obviously, these were not the answers Fitzgerald wanted, and apparently he betrayed his reaction. Frome: "How come you're making those faces?" Fitzgerald: "I'm sorry. Continue." Calling counsel to the bench, Judge Older said, "She can only harm the defendants doing what she is doing." I explained to Older, "If the court is wondering why I am not objecting, it is because I feel that her testimony is helpful to the prosecution." So helpful, in fact, that there was little need for cross-examination. Among the questions I had intended to ask her, for example, was one Kenrick now asked. "Do you think that Charles Manson was Jesus Christ?" Squeaky hesitated a moment before answering. Would she be the apostle who denied Jesus? Apparently, she decided she would not, for she replied, "I think that the Christians in the caves and in the woods were a lot of kids just living and being without guilt, without shame, being able to take off their clothes and lay in the sun. And I see Jesus Christ as a man who came from a woman who did not know who the father of her baby was." Squeaky was the least untruthful of the family members who testified. Yet she was so damaging to the defense that thereafter Fitzgerald let the other defense attorneys call the witnesses. Keith called Brenda McCann, true name Nancy Laura Pittman, 19. Though not unattractive, Brenda came across as a tough, vicious little girl, filled with hostility that was just waiting to erupt. Her father designed the guidance controls of missiles over in the Pentagon, she said. He also kicked her out of the house when she was 16, she claimed. The dropout from Hollywood High School asserted there was no such thing as a family, and Charlie was not a leader at all. It was more like Charlie followed us around and took care of us. But as with Squeaky and the girls who would follow her, it was obvious that Brenda's world revolved around a single axis. He was nobody special, but Charlie would sit down and all the animals would gather round him, donkeys and coyotes and things, and one time he reached down and petted a rattlesnake. Questioned by Kenrick, Brenda testified that Linda would take LSD every day, took speed. Linda loved Tex very much. Linda followed Tex everywhere. On cross-examination, I asked Brenda, "Would you give up your life for Charles Manson if he asked you to?" Answer, "Many times he has given you his life." Question, "Just answer the question, Brenda." Answer, "Yes, I would." Question, "Would you lie on the stand for Charles Manson?" Answer, "No, I would tell the truth on the stand." Question, "So you would die for him, but not lie for him?" Answer, "That's right." Question, "Do you feel that lying under oath is a more serious matter than dying, Brenda?" Answer, "I don't take dying all that seriously myself." All these witnesses were extremely antagonistic toward their real families. Sandra Good, for example, claimed that her father, a San Diego stockbroker, had disowned her, neglecting to mention that this was only after he had sent her thousands of dollars and was threatened by Manson if he didn't give her more. Manson had severed their umbilical cords while fastening one of his own, and throughout their testimony it showed. Even more than Squeaky and Brenda, Sandy rhapsodized on Manson's magical powers. She told the story of how Charlie had breathed on a dead bird and brought it back to life. "I believe his voice could shatter this building if he so desired. Once he yelled, and a window broke." It was not until the penalty trial that the jury learned of the vigil of the family members on the corner of Temple and Broadway. Rather movingly, Sandy testified to life there. "You can hardly see the sky most of the time for the smog. They are always digging. Every day there is a new project going. Something is always under construction. They are always ripping out something and putting something in, usually of a concrete nature. It is insane out there. It's madness, and the more I am out there, the more I feel this X. I am X'd out of it." After I'd declined to cross-examine Sandy, she very angrily asked, "Why didn't you ask me any questions?" "Because you said nothing which hurt the people's case, Sandy," I replied. "In fact, you helped it." I had anticipated that Sandy would testify that Manson wasn't even at Spawn Ranch at the time the murders had occurred. When she didn't, I knew the defense had decided to abandon the idea of using an alibi defense, which meant they had something else in mind. But what? Manson and the three female defendants had been allowed to return to court during the penalty phase. They were much quieter now, far more subdued, as if it had finally got through to them that this play, as Krenwinkel had characterized it, might cost them their lives. While Squeaky and the other Manson girls testified, their mentor looked thoughtful and pulled on his goatee, as if to say, "They're telling it like it is." The female witnesses wore their best clothes for the occasion. It was obvious that they were both proud and happy to be up there helping Charlie. The jurors shared a common expression, incredulity. Few even bothered to take notes. I suspected that all of them were mulling over the astonishing contrast. On the stand, the girls talked of love, music, and babies. Yet while the love and the music and the babies were going on, this same group was going out and butchering human beings. And to them, amazingly enough, there was no inconsistency, no conflict between love and murder. By February 4th, I was fairly sure, from the questions Kenrick had been asking the witnesses, that Manson was not going to take the stand. This was my biggest disappointment during the entire trial, that I wouldn't have the chance to break Charlie on cross-examination. That same day, our office learned that Charles Tex Watson had been returned to Los Angeles and ruled competent to stand trial. Only 3 days after his transfer to Atascadero, Watson had begun eating regular meals. Within a month, one of the psychiatrists who examined him wrote, "There is no evidence of abnormal behavior at the present time except his silence, which is purposeful and with reason." Another later noted, "Psychological testing gave a scatter pattern of responses inconsistent with any recognized form of mental illness." In short, Tex was faking it. All this information would be useful, I knew, if Tex tried to plead insanity during his trial, which was now scheduled to follow the current proceedings. Catherine Scher, a.k.a. Gypsy, was the defense's most effective liar. She was also, at 28, the oldest female member of the family, and of all its members, she had the most unusual background. She was born in Paris in 1942, her father a Hungarian violinist, her mother a German-Jewish refugee. Both parents, members of the French underground, committed suicide during the war. At 8, she was adopted and brought to the United States by an American family. Her adoptive mother, who was suffering from cancer, committed suicide when Catherine was 16. Her adoptive father, a psychologist, was blind. She cared for him until he remarried, at which time she left home. A graduate of Hollywood High School, she had attended college for 3 years, married, divorced a year later. A violin virtuoso since childhood, with an unusually beautiful singing voice, she had obtained work in a number of movies. It was on the set of one, in Topanga Canyon, that she became involved with Bobby Beausoleil, who had a minor role. About 2 months later, Beausoleil introduced her to Charles Manson. Though it was, on her part, love at first sight, she continued traveling with the Beausoleil menage for another 6 months, before splitting for Spahn Ranch. Although she was an avowed communist when she joined the family, Manson soon convinced her that his dogma was ordained. "Of all the girls," Paul Watkins had told me, "Gypsy was most in love with Charlie." She was also the most eloquent in his defense, but though brighter and more articulate than most of the others, she too occasionally slipped up. "We are all facing the same sentence," she told the jury. "We are all in a gas chamber right here in L.A., a slow-acting one. The air is going away from us in every city. There is going to be no more air and no more water, and the food is dying. They are poisoning you. The food you are eating is poisoning you. There is going to be no more earth, no more trees. Man, especially white man, is killing this earth." "But those aren't Charles Manson's thoughts. Those are my thoughts," she quickly added. During her first day on the stand, Gypsy dropped no bombshells. She did try to rebut various parts of the trial testimony. She said that Leslie often went out and stole things to explain away the backhouse incident. She claimed that it was Linda who suggested stealing the $5,000. She also said that Linda didn't want Tanya and had dumped her on the family. It was not until her second day on the stand, on redirect by Kenrick, and immediately after Kenrick had asked to approach the witness and speak to her privately, that Gypsy suddenly came up with an alternative motive, one that was designed to clear Manson of any involvement in the murders. Gypsy claimed that it was Linda Kasabian, not Charles Manson, who had masterminded the Tate-LaBianca murders. "Linda was in love with Bobby Beausoleil," Gypsy said. "When Bobby was arrested for the Hinman murder, Linda proposed that the girls commit other murders which were similar to the Hinman slaying, in the belief that the police would connect the crimes, and realizing that Beausoleil was in custody when these other murders occurred, set him free." The copycat motive was in itself not a surprise. In fact, Aaron Stovitz had suggested it as one of several possible motives in his interview with the reporters from Rolling Stone. There was only one thing wrong with it. It wasn't true. But in an attempt to clear Manson and to cast doubt on the helter-skelter motive, the defense witnesses, starting with Gypsy, now began manufacturing their own bogus evidence. The scenario they had so belatedly fashioned was as transparent as it was self-serving. Gypsy claimed that on the afternoon of August 8, 1969, Linda explained the plan to her and asked her if she wanted to go along. Horrified, Gypsy instead fled to the mountains. When she returned, the murders had already occurred, and Linda was gone. Gypsy further testified that Bobby Beausoleil was innocent of the Hinman murder. All he had done was drive a car belonging to Hinman. And Manson wasn't involved either. The Hinman murder had been committed by Linda, Sadie, and Leslie. Maxwell Keith quickly objected. At the bench, he told Judge Older, "It sounds to me like this girl's leading up to testimony of an admission by my client to her participation in the Hinman, Tate, and LaBianca murders. This is outrageous." The court. "I don't know if Mr. Kenrick has the faintest idea of what he wants to do." Fitzgerald. "I am afraid so." Kenrick. "I know exactly." Keith observed, "I talked to this witness yesterday at the county jail about her testimony. It was sort of innocuous testimony regarding Leslie. And all of a sudden, boom, we are being bombed out of the courtroom. On cross-examination, I asked, 'Isn't it true, Gypsy, that what you were trying to do is clear Charles Manson at the expense of Leslie and Sadie?' Answer, 'I wouldn't say that. No, it isn't true.' To destroy her credibility, I then impeached Gypsy with a number of inconsistent statements she had previously made. Only then did I return to the bogus motive. Gypsy had testified that immediately after hearing of the Tate-LaBianca murders, she was sure that Linda, Leslie, and Sadie were involved. I asked her, 'If in your mind Linda, Sadie, and Leslie were somehow involved in the Tate-LaBianca murders, and Mr. Manson was innocent and had nothing to do with it, why haven't you come forward before today to tell the authorities about this conversation you had with Linda?' Answer, 'I didn't want anything to do with it. I don't believe in coming to you at all.' Earlier on cross-examination, Gypsy had admitted that she loved Manson, that she would willingly die for him. After reminding her of these statements, I said, 'All right. And you believe he had nothing to do with these murders, right?' Answer, 'Right.' Question, 'And yet you let him stay in jail all these months without coming forward with this valuable information?' Gypsy evaded a straight reply. Question, 'When was the first time that you told anyone about this infamous conversation that you had with Linda when she asked you to go out and murder someone?' Answer, 'Right here.' Question, 'Today?' Answer, 'Uh-huh.' Question, 'So today, on the witness stand, was the first time that you decided to release all this valuable information, is that right?' Answer, 'That's right.' I had her. I could now argue to the jury that here's Manson, being tried for 7 counts of murder, and there's Gypsy, out on the corner of Temple and Broadway 24 hours a day since the start of the trial, a girl who loves Manson and would give her life for him, but who waits until well into the penalty trial, and on redirect at that, before she decides to tell anyone what she knows.' At 6:01 a.m. on February 9, 1971, a monster earthquake shook most of Southern California. Measuring 6.5 on the Richter scale, it claimed 65 lives and caused millions of dollars worth of damage. I awoke, thinking the family was trying to break into our house. The jurors awoke to find water cascading on them from broken pipes above their rooms. The girls on the corner told reporters Charlie had caused the quake. Despite the disaster, court resumed at the usual time that morning, with Susan Atkins taking the stand to trigger an earthquake of her own. Day Shin's first question of his client was, Susan, were you personally involved in the Tate and LaBianca homicides? Susan, who was wearing a dark jumper and a white blouse and looking very little girlish, calmly replied, yes. Although by this time all counsel knew that the three girls intended to take the stand and confess, Fitzgerald having mentioned it in chambers nearly a week before, the jury and spectators were stunned. They looked at each other as if disbelieving what they had heard. Shin then took Susan through her background, her early religious years. I sang in the church choir. The death of her mother from cancer. I couldn't understand why she died, and it hurt me. Her loss of faith, her problems with her father. My father kept telling me, you're going downhill, so I just went downhill. Her experiences as a topless dancer in San Francisco. Her explanation for why she was carrying a gun when arrested in Oregon. I was afraid of snakes. And her introduction to drugs, Haight-Ashbury, and her first fateful meeting with Charles Manson. Returning to the crimes, she testified, this whole thing started when I killed Gary Hinman, because he was going to hurt my love. Judge Older called the noon recess. Before leaving the stand, Susan turned toward me and said, look at it, Mr. Bugliosi. Your whole thing, man, is just gone. Your whole motive, it is so silly, so dumb. That afternoon, Sadie recited the newly revised version of how the Hinman murder went down. According to Susan, when Manson arrived at the Hinman residence to persuade Gary to sign over the pink slip on a car they had already purchased, Gary drew a gun on him. As Manson fled, Gary tried to shoot him in the back. I had no choice. He was going to hurt my love. I had my knife on me, and I ran at him, and I killed him. Bobby was taken to jail for something that I did. The holes in her story were a mile wide. I noted them for my cross-examination. After the arrest of Beausoleil, Susan testified, Linda proposed committing copycat murders, and she told me to get a knife and a change of clothes. She said these people in Beverly Hills had burned her for $1,000 for some new drug, MDA. Before leaving Spawn Ranch, Susan said, Linda gave me some LSD, and she gave Tex some STP. Linda issued all the directions that night. No one told Charlie where we were going or what we were going to do. Linda had been there before, so she knew where to go. Tex went crazy, shot parent. Linda went inside the house. Linda gave me her knife. At this point in her narrative, Day Shin opened the blade of the buck knife and started to hand the knife to Susan. The court. Put that knife back the way it was. Shin, I only wanted to get the dimensions, Your Honor. Susan skipped ahead in her narrative. She was holding Sharon Tate, and Tex came back and he looked at her and he said, kill her. And I killed her. And I just stabbed her and she fell, and I stabbed her again. I don't know how many times I stabbed her. Sharon begged for the life of her baby, and I told her, shut up. I don't want to hear it. Though Susan's words were horrifyingly chilling, her expression for the most part remained simple, even childlike. There was only one way to describe the contrast. It was incredibly obscene. In discussing the Hinman murder, Susan had placed Leslie Van Houten at the murder scene. There had never been any evidence whatsoever that Leslie was involved in the Hinman murder. In discussing the night the LaBiancas were killed, Susan made some additional changes in the cast of characters. Manson didn't go along, she said. Linda drove. Tex creepy-crawled the LaBianca residence. Linda instructed Tex, Katie, and Leslie what to do. Linda suggested killing the actor in Venice. And when they returned to Spawn Ranch, Charlie was there sleeping. Just as improbable was another of her fictional embellishments. She had implicated Manson in her conversation with me and in her testimony before the grand jury, she claimed, because I had promised her that if she did so, I would personally see that none of the defendants, including Manson, would receive the death penalty. The best refutation of this was that she had implicated Manson on the tape she made with Caballero days before our first meeting. Describing that meeting, Sadie said, Bugliosi walked in. I think he was dressed similar to the way he is dressed now. Gray suit, vest. Question. This was way back in 1969, right? Answer. Right. He looked a lot younger then. We'd all gone through a lot in the last 14 months. Shin then began questioning Susan about Shorty. I asked to approach the bench. Bugliosi. Your Honor, I can't believe what is going on here. He is talking about Shorty Shea now. Turning to Dave, I said, you are hurting yourself if you bring in other murders, and you are hurting the co-defendants. Older agreed and cautioned Shin to be extremely careful. I was worried that if Shin continued, the case might be reversed on appeal. What conceivable rationale could there be for having your client take the stand and confess to a murder with which she isn't even charged? Fitzgerald took over the direct. He asked Susan why the Tate victims were killed. Answer, because I believed it was right to get my brother out of jail. And I still believe it was right. Question. Miss Atkins, were any of these people killed as a result of any personal hate or animosity that you had toward them? Answer. No. Question. Did you have any feeling toward them at all? Any emotional feeling toward any of these people? Sharon Tate, Wojtek Frakowski, Abigail Folger, Jay Sebring, Stephen Parent. Answer. I didn't know any of them. How could I have felt any emotion without knowing them? Fitzgerald asked Susan if she considered these mercy killings. Answer, no. As a matter of fact, I believe I told Sharon Tate I didn't have any mercy for her. Susan went on to explain that she knew what she was doing was right when I was doing it. She knew this because, when you do the right thing, it feels good. Question. How could it be right to kill somebody? Answer. How could it not be right when it is done with love? Question. Did you ever feel any remorse? Answer. Remorse? For doing what was right to me? Question. Did you ever feel sorry? Answer. Sorry for doing what was right to me? I have no guilt in me. Fitzgerald looked beaten. By bringing out her total lack of remorse, he had made it impossible for the defense to persuasively argue that she was capable of rehabilitation. We had reached a strange situation. Suddenly, in the penalty phase, long after the jury had found the four defendants guilty, I was, in a sense, having to prove Manson's guilt all over again. If I cross-examined too strenuously, it would appear that I did not feel that we had proven our case. If I eschewed cross-examination, there was the possibility of leaving a lingering doubt as to guilt, which, when it came time for their deliberations, could influence the jury's vote on penalty. Therefore, I had to proceed very carefully, as if trying to walk between raindrops. The defense, and specifically Irving Kenrick, had tried to plant such a doubt by providing an alternative to Helter Skelter. The copycat motive. Though I felt the testimony on this was thoroughly unconvincing, this didn't mean I could sit back and presume the jury would feel as I did. As an explanation for why she was lying to save him, it was important that I conclusively prove to the jury Susan Atkins' total commitment to Manson. At the start of my cross-examination, I asked her, Sadie, do you believe Charles Manson is the second coming of Christ? Answer, Vince, I have seen Christ in so many people in the last 4 or 5 years, it is hard for me to say which one exactly is the second coming of Christ. I repeated the question. Answer, I have thought about it. I have thought about it quite a bit. I have entertained the thought that he was Christ, yes. I don't know. Could be. If he is, wow, my goodness. After confronting her with her letter to Ronnie Howard, in which she stated, if you can believe in the second coming of Christ, M is he who has come to save, I asked her, even now on the witness stand, Sadie, you think that maybe Charles Manson, the man over there who was playing with his hair, might be Jesus Christ? Answer, maybe. I will leave it at that. Maybe yes, maybe no. I persisted until Susan admitted he represented a god to me that was so beautiful that I'd do anything for him. Question. Even commit murder? I asked instantly. Answer. I'd do anything for God. Question. Including murder? I pressed. Answer. That's right. If I believed it was right. Question. And you murdered the 5 people at the Tate residence for your god, Manson, didn't you? Susan paused, then said, I murdered them for my god, Bobby Beausoleil. Question. Oh, so you have 2 gods? Evasively, she replied, there is only 1 god, and God is in all. Since Susan had now testified to these matters, the prosecution was able to use her prior inconsistent statements, including her grand jury testimony, for impeachment purposes. On cross-examination, I had Susan repeat the alleged reasons why they went to the Tate residence. Once she'd restated the copycat nonsense, I hit her with her statements regarding Helter Skelter's being the motive, made to me, to the grand jury, and in the Howard letter. I also brought out that she had told me and the grand jury that Manson had ordered the 7 Tate LaBianca murders, that Charlie had directed all their activities the second night, and that none of them had been on drugs either night. I then led her back through her scenario of the Hinman, Tate, and LaBianca murders, step by step, knowing she would slip up, which she did repeatedly. For example, I asked, where was Charles Manson when you stabbed Gary Hinman to death? Answer, he left. He left right after he cut Gary's ear. Having inadvertently admitted this, she quickly added that she had tried to sew up Hinman's ear. I then took her back again. Hinman drew a gun on Manson. Manson ran. Hinman started to shoot Manson. To protect her love, she stabbed Hinman to death. Just when, I asked, did she have time to play Florence Nightingale? Susan further claimed that she didn't tell Manson that she had killed Hinman until after their arrest in the Barker raid. In other words, though she had lived with Manson from July to October 1969, she hadn't got around to mentioning this. That's right. Why? Because he never asked. She hadn't even told him she committed the Tate and LaBianca murders, she claimed. Nor, until 2 days ago, had she told anyone that Linda Kasabian masterminded the murders. Question. Between August 9th, 1969, and February 9th, 1971, how come you never told anyone that Linda was behind these murders? Answer. Because I didn't. It's that simple. Question. Did you tell anyone in the family that you committed all these murders? Answer. No. Question. If you told outsiders like Ronnie Howard and Virginia Graham, how come you didn't tell members of your own family, Sadie? Answer. Nothing needed to be said. What I did was what I did with those people, and that is what I did. Question. Just one of those things. 7 dead bodies. Answer. No big thing. I paused to let this incredible statement sink in before asking, so killing 7 people is just business as usual. No big deal. Is that right, Sadie? Answer. It wasn't at the time. It was just there to do. I asked her how she felt about the victims. She responded, they didn't even look like people. I didn't relate to Sharon Tate as being anything but a store mannequin. Question. You have never heard a store mannequin talk, have you, Sadie? Answer. No, sir. But she just sounded like an IBM machine. She kept begging and pleading and pleading and begging, and I got sick of listening to her. So I stabbed her. Question. And the more she screamed, the more you stabbed, Sadie? Answer. Yes, so? Question. And you looked at her and you said, look, bitch, I have no mercy for you. Is that right, Sadie? Answer. That's right. That's what I said then. Bugliosi. No further questions. On Tuesday, February 16th, after lengthy discussions in chambers, Judge Older told the jury that he had decided to end the sequestration. Their surprise and elation were obvious. They had been locked up for over 8 months, the longest sequestration of any jury in American history. Though I remained worried about possible harassment from the family, most of the other reasons for the sequestration, such as mention of the Hinman murder, Susan Atkins' confession in the Los Angeles Times, her grand jury testimony, and so on, no longer existed, since the jury heard this evidence when Sadie and the others took the stand. It was almost as if we had a new jury. When the 12 entered the box the next day, there were smiles on all their faces. I couldn't remember when I'd last seen them smiling. The smiles would not remain there long. Patricia Krenwinkel now took the stand to confess her part in the Tate and LaBianca homicides. An even more improbable witness than Susan Atkins, her testimony regarding the copycat motive was vague, nebulous, and almost devoid of supporting detail. The point in her taking the stand was to take the focus off Manson. Instead, like the other family members who had preceded her, she repeatedly highlighted his importance. For example, describing life at Spahn Ranch, she said, "We were just like wood nymphs and wood creatures. We would run through the woods with flowers in our hair, and Charlie would have a small flute." On the murder of Abigail Folger, "And I had a knife in my hands, and she took off running, and she ran. She ran out through the back door, one I never even touched. I mean, nobody got fingerprints because I never touched that door. And I stabbed her, and I kept stabbing her." Question: what did you feel after you stabbed her? Answer: nothing. I mean, like, what is there to describe? It was just there, and it's like it was right. On the murder of Rosemary LaBianca, according to Katie, she and Leslie took Rosemary LaBianca into the bedroom and were looking through the dresses in her closet when, hearing Lino scream, Rosemary grabbed a lamp and swung at them. On the mutilation of Lino LaBianca, after murdering Rosemary, Katie remembered seeing Lino lying on the floor in the living room. She flashed, "You won't be sending your son off to war," and, "I guess I put war on the man's chest, and then I guess I had a fork in my hands and I put it in his stomach, and I went and wrote on the walls." On cross-examination, I asked her, "When you were on top of Abigail Folger, plunging your knife into her body, was she screaming?" Answer: yes. Question: and the more she screamed, the more you stabbed? Answer: I guess. Question: did it bother you when she screamed for her life? Answer: no. Katie testified that when she stabbed Abigail, she was really stabbing herself. My next question was rhetorical. "But you didn't bleed at all, did you, Katie? Just Abigail did, isn't that right?" The defense was contending, through these witnesses, that the words "political piggy," Hinman, "pig," Tate, and "death to pigs," LaBianca, were the clue which the killers felt would cause the police to link the three crimes. But when I'd asked Sadie why she'd written "political piggy" on the wall of the Hinman residence in the first place, she had no satisfactory answer. Nor could she tell me why, if these were to be copycat murders, she'd only written "pig" and not "political piggy" at Tate. Nor was Katie now able to give a convincing explanation as to why she'd written "Helter Skelter" on the LaBianca's refrigerator door. It was obvious that Maxwell Keith wasn't buying the copycat motive either. On redirect, he asked Katie, "The homicides at the Tate residence and the LaBianca residence had nothing to do, did they, with trying to get Bobby Beausoleil out of jail?" Answer: well, it's hard to explain. It was just a thought, and the thought came to be. Judge Older was becoming increasingly irritated with Kenrick. Repeatedly, he warned him that if he persisted in asking inadmissible questions, he would find him in contempt for the fifth time. Nor was he very happy with Day Shin. Shin had been observed passing a note from a spectator to Susan Atkins. The week before, the girls on the corner had been seen reading court transcripts which had Shin's name on them. Confronted with this by Older, Shin explained, "They borrowed them to look at them." The court: "I beg your pardon. Are you familiar with the publicity order in this case? Shin admitted that he was. The court. It appears to me, Mr. Shin, that you are not paying the slightest attention to the publicity order, and you haven't been for some time. I have felt in my own mind for a long, long time that the leak, and there is a leak, is you. Maxwell Keith very reluctantly called his client Leslie Van Houten to the stand. After taking her through her background, Keith asked to approach the bench. He told Older that his client was going to involve herself in the Hinman murder. He had discussed this with her for hours and hours, but to no avail. Once she began reciting her tale, the transparency of her fictions became obvious. According to Leslie, Mary Brunner was never at the Hinman residence, while both Charles Manson and Bobby Beausoleil left before the actual killing took place. It was Sadie, she said, who killed Gary. Though implicating herself in the Hinman murder, at least by her presence, Leslie did try to provide some mitigating circumstances for her involvement in the LaBianca murders. She claimed she knew nothing about the Tate murders, and that when she went along the next night, she had no idea where they were going or what they were going to do. The murder of Rosemary LaBianca was made to seem almost like self-defense. Only after Rosemary swung at her with the lamp did she take one of the knives, and Patricia had a knife, and we started stabbing and cutting up the lady. Question. Up to that time, did you have any intention of hurting anybody? Answer. No. Question. Did you stab her after she appeared to be dead? Less. Answer. I don't know if it was before or after she was dead, but I stabbed her. I don't know if she was dead. She was lying there on the floor. Question. Had you stabbed her at all before you saw her lying on the floor? Answer. I don't remember. Leslie's forgetting such things was almost as improbable as her claim that she hadn't mentioned the murders to Manson until they were in the desert. Very carefully, Keith tried to establish that Leslie had remorse for her acts. Question. Leslie, do you feel sorrow or shame or a sense of guilt for having participated in the death of Mrs. LaBianca? Answer. Pause. Question. Let me go one by one. Do you feel sorrowful about it? Sorry, unhappy. You could almost feel the chill in the courtroom when Leslie answered, sorry is only a five-letter word. It can't bring back anything. Question. I am trying, Leslie, to discover how you feel about it. Answer. What can I feel? It has happened. She is gone. Question. Do you wish that it hadn't happened? Answer. I never wish anything to be done over another way. That is a foolish thought. It never will happen that way. You can't undo something that is done. Question. Do you feel as if you wanted to cry for what happened? Answer. Cry? For her death? If I cry for death, it is for death itself. She is not the only person who has died. Question. Do you think about it from time to time? Answer. Only when I am in the courtroom. Through most of the trial, Leslie Van Houten had maintained her innocent little girl act. She'd dropped it now, the jury seeing for the first time how cold and unfeeling she really was. Another aspect of her real nature surfaced when Kenrick examined her. Angry and impatient at some of his questions, she snapped back hostile, sarcastic replies. With each spurt of venom, you could see the jurors drawing back, looking at her as if anew. Whatever sympathy she may have generated earlier was gone now. Even McBride no longer met her eyes. Leslie Van Houten had been found guilty of two homicides. I felt she deserved the death penalty for her very willing participation in those acts. But I didn't want the jury to vote death on the basis of a crime she didn't even commit. I told her attorney, Maxwell Keith, that I was willing to stipulate that Leslie was not at the Hinman residence. I mean, the jury is apt to think she was and hold it against your client, and I don't think that is right. Also, during cross-examination, I asked, did you tell anyone, prior to your testimony on the witness stand, that it was you who was along with Sadie and Bobby Beausoleil at Gary Hinman's house? Answer, I told Patricia about it. Question, actually it was Mary Brunner who was inside the residence, not you, isn't that correct? Answer, that is what you say. Although I was attempting to exonerate Leslie of any complicity in the Gary Hinman murder, I did the opposite when it came to the murder of Rosemary LaBianca. By the time I'd finished my cross-examination on this, Leslie had admitted that Rosemary might still have been alive when she stabbed her, and that she not only stabbed her in the buttocks and possibly the neck, but I could have done a couple on the back. As I'd later remind the jury, many of the back wounds were not post-mortem, while one, which severed Rosemary LaBianca's spine, would have been in and of itself fatal. As with Sadie and Katie, I emphasized the improbabilities in her copycat tale. For example, though she had testified that she was hopelessly in love with Bobby Beausoleil and became aware that these murders had been committed in an attempt to free him, I brought out that she hadn't even offered to testify in either of his trials, when her story, had it been true, could have resulted in his release. At this point I decided to go on a fishing expedition. Though I had no definite knowledge that this was so, I strongly suspected that Leslie had told her first attorney, Marvin Part, the true story of these murders. I did know that Part had recorded her story, and, though I never heard the tape, I recalled Part almost begging the judge to listen to it. Bugliosi, isn't it true, Leslie, that before the trial started you told someone that Charles Manson ordered these killings? Answer, I had a court-appointed attorney, Marvin Part, who was insistent on the fact that I was... Keith interrupted her, objecting that we were getting into the area of privileged communications. I noted to Judge Older that Leslie herself had mentioned Part by name and that she had the right to waive that privilege. Kennerick also objected, well aware of what I was hoping to bring out. Van Houten, Mr. Kennerick, will you shut up so I can answer his question? I had a court-appointed attorney by the name of Marvin Part. He had a lot of different thoughts, which were all his own, on how to get me off. He said he was going to make some tape recordings, and he told me the gist of what he wanted me to say. And I said it. Question, what did you tell Mr. Part? Answer, I don't remember. It was a long time ago. I asked her if she told Part that Manson had ordered these murders. Answer, sure, I told him that. Did she tell Part that Manson was along the second night, and that when they stopped on Waverly Drive, Manson got out and entered the LaBianca house? After a number of evasive replies, Leslie angrily answered, sure, I told him that. The court, we will take our recess at this time. Van Houten, Mr. Bugliosi, you are an evil man. Each of the family witnesses denied that Manson hated blacks, but in the light of what I'd recently learned, several put it in a very curious way. When Fitzgerald asked Squeaky, did he love the black man or did he hate him? She had replied, he loved them. He is his father. The black man is Charlie's father. Gypsy had testified, first of all, Charlie spent nearly all of his life in jail, so he got to know the black people very, very well. In fact, I mean, they were like his father, you know. Leslie had said something very similar, adding, if Charlie hated black people, he would hate himself. During a recess, I asked Manson, Charlie, was your father black? What? He seemed startled by the question, yet whether because it was such a crazy idea or because I'd found out something he didn't want known, I couldn't tell. There was nothing evasive about his eventual response, however. He emphatically denied it. He seemed to be telling the truth. Yet I wondered. I still do. The next witness was no stranger to the stand. Brought back from New Hampshire at the request of Irving Kenrick, Linda Kasabian was again sworn. Fitzgerald, Keith, and Shin had opposed calling her, Kenrick should have listened to their advice, as Linda again came over so well that I didn't even cross-examine her. None of her previous testimony was shaken in the slightest. Linda, her husband, and their two children were living together on a small farm in New Hampshire. The footloose Bob Kasabian had turned out to be a pillar of strength, and I was pleased to hear that their marriage now seemed to be working. Ruth Ann Morehouse, a.k.a. Uish, age 20, who'd once told Danny DiCarlo she couldn't wait to get her first pig, repeated the now familiar refrain, Charlie was no leader. But the rattlesnakes liked him. He could play with them, and he could change old men into young men. Adding a few more fictional touches to the copycat motive, Uish claimed that Bobby Beausoleil was the father of Linda Kasabian's second child. I asked her, "You would do anything to help Charles Manson and these three female defendants, wouldn't you, Uish?" When she evaded a direct reply, I asked, "You would even murder for them, wouldn't you?" Answer, "I could not take a life." Question, "All right, let's talk about that, Uish. Do you know a girl by the name of Barbara Hoyt?" On the advice of her attorney, Uish refused to answer any questions about the Hoyt murder attempt. By law, when a witness refuses to be cross-examined, that witness's entire testimony can be stricken. This was done in Uish's case. Easily the weirdest of all the witnesses was Steve Grogan, a.k.a. Clem, age 19. He spoke of the engrams on his brain, answered questions about his father by talking about his mother, and claimed that the real leader of the family was not Manson, but Pooh Bear, Mary Brunner's child by Manson. Kenrick complained at the bench that Older was smiling at Grogan's replies. Older responded, "I find nothing whatsoever funny about this witness, I can assure you. Why you would want to call him is beyond my comprehension, but that is up to you. No jury will ever believe this witness, I promise you that." The youth who beheaded Shorty Shea appeared to be a complete idiot. He grinned incessantly, made funny faces, and played with his beard even more than Manson. Yet it was more than partly role-playing, as several of his very careful replies indicated. Clem recalled accompanying Linda, Leslie, Sadie, Tex, and Katie one night in a car. He claimed that Linda had given them all LSD first, and he insisted that Manson was not along. But he was very careful not to say that this was the night of the LaBianca murders, to avoid implicating himself. Many of his responses were almost exact quotations from Manson. For example, when I asked him, "When did you join the family, Clem?" he replied, "When I was born of white skin." I also asked him, since it had been brought out on the direct examination, about his arrest in the Barker raid. "What had he been charged with?" I inquired. Answer, "I was arrested on a breach of promise." Question, "Breach of promise? Some girl you made a promise to, Clem, or what?" Answer, "It was a promise to return a truck on a certain date." Question, "Oh, I get it. Sometimes that is called Grand Theft Auto, too, isn't it, Clem?" The defense called their next witness, Vincent T. Bugliosi. At the bench, Fitzgerald admitted that this was an unusual situation. "On the other hand, in this case, Mr. Bugliosi has been an investigator as well as a prosecutor." Day Shin questioned me about my interview with Susan Atkins and her testimony before the grand jury. "Why did I feel Susan hadn't told the grand jury the whole truth?" he asked. I enumerated the reasons, noting, among other things, my belief that she had stabbed Sharon Tate. Question, "How did you come to that conclusion?" Answer, "She admitted it on the witness stand, Mr. Shin, for one thing. Also, she told Ronnie Howard and Virginia Graham that she stabbed Sharon Tate." Shin was trying to reinstate the deal in which the DA's office agreed not to seek the death penalty against Susan if she testified truthfully. As Older told him at the bench, "Susan Atkins took the stand in this case under oath and testified that she was lying at the grand jury. If there'd been any agreement, that in itself would have been enough to negate it. Keith asked me if I had either heard the tape Leslie made with Part or discussed its contents with him. I replied that I had not. Kenrick's cross-examination went so far afield that Judge Older finally terminated it.
Others who took the stand in succeeding days included Aaron Stovitz,